I'm Robert Frank. I've been a professor at Cornell since 1972. Most people, when they discover you're an economist, they look for a way to exit the conversation. And usually what they would say is something to the effect, oh, I'd taken an introductory course all these years ago and there were these horrible equations and graphs. That's not really the way the brain absorbs information most easily. There's evidence now that the standard introductory economics course doesn't leave much of an imprint on students. So they'll give tests of basic economic principles 6 months after the course, and they actually can't tell who took the course from who didn't. The far more natural approach is to consider an actual question and then try to answer it, and then the principle almost emerges all by itself. I've been giving a writing assignment in my economics courses to pose an interesting question based on something you've seen in the world, and then try to use basic economic reasoning to answer it. And I've been thinking for years to compile the best ones, plus a lot of the examples I show them. People ask where the title of the book comes from, and I think really it's inspired by the concept of the field biologist, the field naturalist. I'd taken a couple of biology courses long before I ever took an economics course, and I was always really impressed by how much more the things I saw when I walked around meant to me as a result of having taken those biology courses. Just a little bit of biological theory just adds so much texture and pattern to the things you see out in the natural world. And really, it's the same with economics. A handful of very simple principles help you make sense of some really interesting and puzzling patterns that you observe. An interesting question oftentimes has some element of paradox or twist to it. It's a question that makes the listener respond, "Yeah, why is that?" One of my favorite student questions was, why is it that the drive-up cash machines have braille dots on the keypad buttons? You know, obviously none of the drivers who drive up to those machines is blind, so why do they need braille dots? The dots don't cause any trouble for you and me when we use the drive-up machine, so it's just cheaper. We could have made two different kinds of machines. It would have been costly. There would be no benefit to speak of to doing that, so it just didn't pay to do it. So from that example emerges what we call the cost-benefit principle. The cost-benefit principle says, do something if the benefits are greater than the costs. If you ask New Yorkers directions in the street, some of them will stop and be polite, but often they won't even make eye contact. The menu of things to do in New York, the amount you can earn in an hour's time in New York, all those are among the highest in the world. So if you stop for 5 minutes, the value of what you give up is much higher there than in just about any city in the world. And so I think taking the value of what you're asking people to give up into account, it's not so surprising that they might be a little bit more impatient. My all-time favorite question was submitted by Jennifer Dulski in 1997. She asked, why is it that brides spend thousands of dollars on a wedding dress they'll never ever wear again, whereas grooms, who will have lots of occasions to wear a tuxedo in the future, they go out and rent a cheap suit? What's going on here? She said, well, women are trying to make a fashion statement on big social occasions, much more so than men. And most people seem to find that a reasonable assumption about human nature. And if you take that as your starting point, then, well, for a woman to make a fashion statement in a rental gown, she would have to have a large number of gowns to choose from. Let's just say 50, 100 gowns in each size the rental company would have to carry in its inventory. And then the gowns would rent out only very infrequently, maybe every 5 or 6 years. And so they'd have to charge so much just to cover their costs of keeping that big inventory that the rental price of the gown would be a little bit higher than the purchase price, in which case nobody would actually find it worthwhile to rent it. They'd just go and buy it. Whereas for men, they're willing to show up in a standard style suit, and so the rental company can keep an inventory of 2 or 3 suits in each size, and the suits turn over 6-7 times a year. That means they can rent them out for about a quarter of the purchase price. And if you're on a budget, which most couples are when they're getting married, that's a place where you can save a few bucks. The nice thing about this for the students is that they'll come back at reunion 10-15 years later, and the first thing they'll want to do is tell me about something they explained recently. So they're, you know, they're still at this. Let's clear away some of the formalism and the clutter and get back to the basic feeling of wanting to know, well, why is it that way?